Judy Rubenstein and Ann Fagan interviewing Rabbi William Sagewitz on May 5th, 1985. Rabbi, when we left you last session, you were just telling us about the time that when you left Hillel at Berkeley, the University of San Francisco, and began a new career in the South?
From Berkeley, I went to Stockton, California.
Oh, okay, you told us about that. I'm sorry, when you were in the Southeast region.
That was a few intervals later.
Okay, sorry. Would you tell us about that time of your life?
Well, that was a very exciting time of life because there were several things that were happening civically. The South was in the midst of an uproar because of the civil rights situation, and many of our congregations there were in a dilemma because most Jews are liberal, and yet some of them had great deal of tension and fear because their existence depended upon their relationship with their neighbors. And if they came out, many of them as liberals, questions could come. I had one woman who told me that she had been part of an integrated Bible group of women. And she was the wife of a doctor. And lo and behold, someone from the reactionary group had taken the license plates of everyone there and had reported it to their, quote, their group. Her husband lost about 30% of his practice within 2 weeks. So that they were really on the firing line, and it was very easy for us to understand what should be done, but they were right in the midst of it. So for me, the union was just beginning to build, to raise funds for a religious action center in Washington. And religious action center to the people there meant liberalism and meant strikes, it meant everything possible, and our congregations were in no mood for this. And yet my task was to raise funds for that. My task was to see that they didn't secede from the Union of American Hebrew Congregations. And my task at the same time was to raise funds to build a camp in Cleveland, Georgia. In the midst of everything, for example, before the march, you know, the famous march.
Are you talking about 1960?
Right.
Okay.
Al Vorspan was going to come and meet with Martin Luther King in one of our prominent communities. I'll leave it unsaid right now. And lo and behold, the Board of Trustees got together and wired the Union of American Hebrew Congregation that Vorspan could not be allowed to enter their community. And it was a very sad kind of thing because the rabbi had then been forced into a battle with his board. He had been there for his lifetime. He lost the battle. And he continued as their rabbi, but I think with a great deal of pain for the decision they had made. Of course he came anyway. And history will record the rest of the progress of the situation. But those were difficult times. And very exciting at the same time, because you felt you were doing something in your own small way. My wife, we had our headquarters in Miami, but since I was building a camp in Cleveland, Georgia, mm-hmm. about 20 miles out of Atlanta, I had to fly up frequently in order to have meetings and so forth. And it was also a difficult time in that situation. Every congregation had to be visited at least once every 2 years. This was 4.5 states I had to cover. So I made a deal. I would cover the territory 1 week a month, which meant I would have breakfast in one place, lunch in another, and another meeting dinner someplace else. So it was a very busy time. And I think my final blow came when I was sat down to a breakfast at someone's house and they served fried liver. That did it. That did it. 8 o'clock in the morning, fried liver, and forget it. So that was really part of something that was very exciting. We had to leave there because my daughter unfortunately suffered with an allergy to the fungus, to the mold that grows around there. And from the very beginning, she suffered terribly. And lo and behold, you know, I was supposed to be there for 5 years, but after 2 years, we had to leave. And it saddened me because I built a camp and was met some wonderful people there. But there was no alternative.
Were you there at the inception of the camp? Can you tell us something about?
I stayed for the dedication and already had been committed to Chicago. Mm-hmm. But the strange thing was the daughter who had suffered there goes to Chicago with all the cold and all the dirt and everything else. Absolutely wonderful. Walk to school, walk back, but it was really the different kind of climate that bothered me.
Could you tell? Do you want to tell us a little bit more about the camp? Was that
the camp was really the first camp that was built from the ground up. Mm-hmm. In other words, we had bought some. Union had bought other camps, but this was the very first time that they built from scratch. Now, I knew nothing about how to build the camp, but fortunately, we had a magnificent committee, including Harry Popkin of Blue Star Camp, which is one of the country's outstanding camps in the Blue Hills Mountains, you know, and it was excellent. So building a camp, it was a kind of camp that basically we were taking our youth for leadership training. Mm-hmm. And it was so valuable because some of the people from small towns, the kids that really no one to associate with, then became very close friends with someone that they could visit them. It was a boon to them. It was really very valuable. Mm-hmm.
And the name of the camp was?
At first it was a Union of American Hebrew Congregations, but later it became the Camp Coleman because he had been one of our primary contributors in Jackson, Florida. But it was I think it was the first really successful camp from the standpoint of there had never been a problem getting kids to come. Because there had been such a need in this particular area. Mm-hmm. Again, a 4.5 state area, so it was very good.
You worked with young adults in many areas, certainly within your congregations, but when you were the Hillel rabbi and so forth. Could you tell us what it was like working with young adults or the feelings also in the South of the civil rights times? You know, where the adults who were involved in making money were more torn. But did you see trends in the teenagers?
There was a little bit of it, but the real liberal American Jewish youth came from the East, came from metropolitan areas. For the most part, these people had lived in a relatively isolated world. Mm-hmm. And they had made adjustments to the circumstances. This is the way it was in the time they had ever known. So the people who came in, if you remember in the civil rights rights movement, really came in from the East and were much more concerned, which is natural.
Mm-hmm. And did you interact with them much or just on the periphery?
Well, you see, I was a rabbinical advisor for the youth of the area, so I had opportunity to work with them. I think to help them understand, but to bring them to action, I think would take some time at that particular time. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Reverend Martin Luther King. Did you have occasion to meet him at all?
No, I didn't. Mm-hmm. He was very involved in the national scene and very little involved really in the local scene until later on. Mm-hmm. And we had a department of social action where we brought our people in for that particular purpose.
When we met the last time, you mentioned Rabbi Heschel. Could you tell us
Rabbi
a little bit about
Heschel,
that?
Well, Rabbi Heschel, when he came into Hebrew in college, was one of the people who had really been rescued from death. One of the great scholars and authors. But he was really out of place at Hebrew in college because he was really very traditional, very orthodox. And at that time, we were very far from orthodox. And he had been used, I'm sure, to lecturing before people who were sitting, you know, literally sitting at his feet in order to, out of the respect that they had heard of, that they knew should be given to him. Well, he'd been in college as a mixture of young adults at that particular time, many with good sense of humor and the pranks and all of the things that go into this kind of relationship. So for Dr. Heschel, I'm sure it was a very difficult time. And yet there were some people that fastened very closely to him. My brother-in-law-to-be, Rabbi Dresner, was to become his disciple and ultimately left the Reform rabbinate. We're quite sure it was when Heschel moved and he moved to Jewish Theological Seminary with him and became his, probably the outstanding disciple that he had in the country. So somehow I too had a good relationship with him. Not a scholarly relationship, but just one in which we could talk very nicely. And it was he whom I used to take to the gym and try to help orient him to an American scene, which was quite a contrast for him. But of course he became one of the spiritual giants of the country. And the most amazing thing was to see him, who had come here with a great background of prophetic Judaism, you know, a scholar in these fields, put his prophets into action, because he became as this Orthodox Jew became the representative of Judaism, really, in the non-Jewish community. I was at many conferences with him, and I saw him address Catholic, Protestants, tremendous mixtures, and it was like the fire in his eyes, the flame of the prophet was coming out, and he really did a marvelous job, not only in his writing, but in his standing up for justice. He didn't just write about it.
Did Rabbi Joshua Heschel also influence you in your spiritual...
Oh,
I'm sorry, Abraham.
Yeah.
In your feelings of spirituality that you tried to convey to us last time?
Yes and no. Yes and no. On the one hand, I was too really preoccupied running back and forth to Dayton, Ohio to teach, doing club work with AZA in Price Hill, and it's always involved with youth in some way. And even though there was a spiritual lack everywhere, I don't think I was ready myself for Heschel's brand of Judaism. And that's my fault, not his.
Were there any other leading figures that you had personal interaction with that you might like to share with us?
I really think that by and large, certainly, I had a relationship with Jay Kaufman, who had been national vice president, the executive of B'nai B'rith. He too was a classmate of mine at Hebrew College, a great man who died, unfortunately, much too soon. Dr. Eisenblatt of the Union of American Hebrew Congregation, who was really a fighter for the cause of social action. He was magnificent, really courageous human being. Now Dr. Schindler, who's coming to speak on the Friday night of the weekend, who brought the union something completely different. He brought a strong voice and a courageous stand, but he also brought a touch of spirituality. He really did. It was, again, very necessary to return somehow to the roots of faith, to getting the feel of who he is. And I think he did a magnificent, has done a magnificent job in growth. And Al Borstman, who of course was the leader of a whole movement in social action, that was what was so wonderful about the times that I was with the union in that short space of time. Some wonderful relationships were established, which are still there today.
And then you went on to Chicago?
Yeah, I went from there to Chicago. And Chicago, again, was in the midst of a social action problem of its own. I went to a congregation in the South Side. My wife was a North Sider from Chicago. Never the twain could mix or meet. And it was in a time where the black community had just begun to come into the South Side of Chicago. And there was great hope that for once, this area would be integrated. A marvelous interfaith, interracial community organization had started. And there was really the hope that here, where we would be able to take a stand. So I came there, feeling, knowing what was there, and yet feeling that perhaps this would be it. And it was a very disheartening experience to see it completely fail as more and more influx came in, and where a large apartment still had two white people, when they left, there were sometimes three and four families that took their place with eight or nine children, and it became no one's fault, but you know, these poor young kids were, you'd see them with the string around their neck in the house, their apartment was 6, 7 years old, and it was a rough time. It was a pretty good time. My daughter mixed magnificently. We lived ourselves in a home in a very lovely section with very lovely Negro black neighbors that were lovely people, and we visited with one another. In fact, when we went to leave, we went up to apologize to them that we were leaving. But what had happened is that the teachers had come to us from the school and had said to us that she was the only white child left. And they said that they felt that for the child's sake, the learning opportunity would be greater somewhere else. And we didn't want to send her to private school, the University of Chicago. My older daughter had gone there. We were not too happy with it because it was people on all one particular level. So we moved to a hotel on the lake, which had been converted to condominiums, and our daughter thus could go to a smaller school, which was completely integrated, successfully integrated, because it was a large part of the faculty of the University of Chicago, and children of all faiths and all colors were there. The best part about it was these were people who traveled, you see. These were people whose kids were, shall I say, poor but sophisticated. I don't mean it in that sense, but they had a fine background. Their homes were filled with books. There was culture. There was all of this. And great experience. Career most happy. And unfortunately, the congregation dropped from 900 families to 250 families.
Changing
as did the whole community. The whole community, the Jewish community, practically vanished within 5 years after we left. It vanished. But to be in a congregation and see it disintegrate before your very eyes was heartbreaking, because this had been the pillar of the community. It's been a fantastic congregation. And it hurt. So that's when, at the age of 49, I stopped here on the way back from a conference and found young congregation, lots of children. And you see, I couldn't exist without children. Mm-hmm. I loved kids. I was always in Chicago. I was a rabbinical advisor. I'd go on retreats with them. That was part of my mm-hmm. pattern some years ago. I still like them, but I can't stay up for a weekend anywhere anymore. No way.
So you arrived at Temple Emmanuel in the South Hills in Pittsburgh in
1968.
Can you give your impressions of the community when you arrived?
Strange thing is I didn't have a feeling of a community in the South Hills because it's not joined together physically. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a mountain, a hill here and another hill there, and there's no, the downtown of Mount Lebanon is relatively very small. So it seemed very strange at first. And yet, Pittsburgh being so near, it was very simple to go downtown, to get all of the things that you had in Chicago, so that it was most enjoyable. Although the congregation, I don't need to say although, when I came here, Harold Silver, Dr. Silver, had been the rabbi. And there was much reflected here of classical Reform Judaism, which was perfectly natural. The children here who went to religious school in the city, for the most part, had been at River Church. Our people would drive them round trip most of the way. And people, a few leaders from Sinai, and some from Rhoda, got together, began to help build the building. By the time I came here, they had a building and probably about 400 members. So they were well on the way. But it was not one reform. All right?
But you made it.
I think so. Mm-hmm. Other people certainly participated, mm-hmm. but it was a kind of a struggle for a while. Did we discuss this before?
We haven't at all. And I just wanted to mention that the Temple Emmanuel was formed in 1953 with about 50 Jewish families from maybe 11 different communities in the South Hills area. So it's interesting to hear you're saying by 1968 already there were 400 families in the South Hills.
The growth was
I mean, just
the growth was when I mm-hmm. came in, you know, they were taking 70 new members at a time and keeping the vast majority of them because here there weren't people retiring at that particular time. Mm-hmm. Now we have people retiring, moving away, mm-hmm. but that pattern hadn't been there at all at that particular time.
Right, there were very few Jewish people within the whole South Hills area prior to this time. Would you say that most of the people were moving out here for, was it for good schools? Was it for nicer suburban homes?
I think the basic reason for coming was that the school system is outstanding. Most of our parents everywhere, most Jewish parents are concerned about the education of their children. And they could get a lovely home at reasonable rates. And in those days, they had the process of first moving into an apartment. Then they went into a very small, modest home. There were always two or three jumps. I'm not sure that's happened to our young marrieds today. I think they wait for the big jump. And in those days, no, you knew this was not where they were going to be. And, you know, in this 15, 16 years, in the 17 years I'm here, the changes in the shift of population is just amazing. Upper St. Clair came up out of the blue. I think as perhaps 7 years ago, if someone had asked me, should they move to Upper St. Clair, I would have said, yes, if your children have grown. Or yes, if your children are very liberal. But I was afraid to be in a community of this size and to feel lonesome and out of it would be very difficult. Even today, Rabbi Mahler was talking at our annual meeting and
the assistant rabbi,
the associate rabbi who will be my successor. And he was indicating that we still suffer from a kind of division between the kids from Upper St. Clair, the kids from here, the kids from Mount Lebanon, the kids from Shar Valley, because when kids get together at Sunday school, they don't have time to really visit. So they meet to talk with their kids from the schools that they're from. And it will take a while to begin to weave them together. There have been certainly a lot of exceptions that ended up with presidents and officers from all of the varied regions, but it takes gregarious kids to make that adjustment successfully. And those who aren't outgoing will have difficulties. I imagine that's true in almost any congregation where you don't have a large based Jewish community right adjacent to it. And it certainly happened here, but today I think 30% of our people are from Upper St. Clair.
When you first arrived, what did you see as the immediate needs to try to meet the congregation or to improve it?
Well, the interesting thing is I told them I wouldn't have any changes the first year. No, everything. I would just listen, and I would hear, and I would observe. It's easy to say, but it's not so easy to do. The first struggle came over a bat mitzvah. I had had two daughters bat mitzvah before this, and to come here and have them refuse a bat mitzvah was very disturbing. And lots of people fought that battle because the founders of the group, truthfully, probably felt it was too Jewish. You know, it was, actually they said that it's too Orthodox, which was absolutely nonsense, because in Orthodoxy no one goes, women don't go on the pulpit. But I think there was an apprehension that this would be an intrusion of more Judaism, now required of their daughters, not alone of their sons. And within a very short time, I think I was here 3 months, and I was disturbed because of their bar mitzvahs. They didn't read from the service. There was a very minimal participation. And I really thought that our task was to prepare children who were bar mitzvah to be able to conduct and feel at home in their own service. So they had to start with the bar chul and go all the way to the native words. They had to pay their dues, so that there also was enough work about this, because this was imposing such a burden upon their children, they could never do it. Then on the other hand, they liked the rabbi to read the services, and they were afraid the children would just make it very unhappy. It was all wrong. It really proved to be all wrong, because our kids are doing a magnificent task. Surely they're going 3 days a week now in order to do it, but it was a transition. That had to be done. Had I indicated that this would take place when I came, I didn't even know it would take place. I was here and I had to see what had to be done. But the process is what I think is interesting. None of this was achieved by fiat of the rabbi. It had to go through the committees had to see the light, the committees had to fight the board, but it came through the congregation. It also came when you realize that as people settled here, they weren't all at home. And there were many people who had come expecting a different kind of a background. And thus, when they came, I think if we were to really take a survey of our congregation today to discover how many came from Reformed roots or not, I would say that perhaps 40% came from Reformed homes, mm-hmm. but right now perhaps 60%. Did not. But that's explained from the impact mm-hmm. of other people moving. It's nice to see now that we have our people, 50% of our people represent 40 to 50% second generation people in the area, which is really very
nice.
Good. Yeah, she takes Jeff London, his family. And there are so many now that have come up. They are our grandchildren coming up. And it's been a tremendous source of strength to one another. Because on the other hand, when I first came here, I had people say to me that they were not going to make friends because their friends disappeared so quickly. You see, a lot of our membership is composed of people on their way up into the organizational structures of whether it was steel mills or banks or whatever. We were in that kind of category. And sales offices, all of these are here regionally. So that many of our people became transients. They would be here for 3 to 8 years. But by the time they came here,